The second case of the morning is Blickenstaff versus R.R. Donnelly and Sons. Ms. Ayers.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Gwyneth Ayers on behalf of Plaintiff Catherine Blickenstaff. May it please the Court. As you know from reading the brief, there are really two separate issues here on appeal. One is the denial of benefits to Mrs. Blickenstaff, and the other is an entry of sanctions against counsel. I'd like to address the sanctions issues first. Very simply, the court's order granting sanctions was entered on March 21, 2003. In that order, the judge stated that the second amended complaint plainly realleged claims against defendants Hartford and Donnelly that were dismissed with prejudice. This is incorrect. Upon a review of the judge's order, the judge clearly stated that there were two types of claims at issue. One was a claim for benefits under 502A1B of ERISA, and one was a claim for fiduciary duty, breach of fiduciary duty under 502A3. The judge clearly held that no claim had been stated for a breach of fiduciary duty. Thus, when the court dismissed claims against defendants Hartford and Donnelly, those claims were claims under 502A1B for benefits, not claims for breach of fiduciary duty. So in the second amended complaint, when we alleged claims for breach of fiduciary duty, those claims in counsel's mind had not yet been stated and thus had not been dismissed with prejudice, which is why we were asserting them at that time. The second holding that the...
Were you counsel below, Ms. Ayers?
Yes, I was co-counsel at that time.
So the First Amendment complaint didn't include the claim for breach of fiduciary duty. Did your response to the motion to dismiss argue that the complaint did assert a 502A3 claim?
Yes, Your Honor. We argued that under notice pleading that we had asserted it. However, upon review, we weren't quite sure we had asserted it, which is why we actually submitted a motion to amend the complaint. And that I mailed that actually from Colorado. I'm a Colorado attorney. And it was mailed on the same day that the judge entered her order dismissing the claim.
See, I realized that you hadn't seen that ruling when you submitted your first motion to amend the complaint. But by the time of the filing of the second motion to amend, you had seen the ruling.
Yes,
Your Honor. So why wasn't the court entitled to sanction for attempting to plead a fiduciary claim in the second motion?
Because the court had ruled in its order that we had not stated a claim. So it was not dismissing a claim that we had stated. It said there was no claim asserted. And so it was dismissing claims against defendants Hartford and Donnelly, assuming that we had made claims based on failure to provide benefits.
But here's what she said when she granted the motion to dismiss and strike in part. She said, there is no reason to allow Blickenstaff to amend her complaint to sufficiently allege a breach of fiduciary duty claim against either Donnelly or Hartford.
Well, Your Honor, at that point we had not, she'd held that we hadn't even asserted them, and she held that she was dismissing claims based on claims for benefits. So in our minds, if we hadn't asserted them, then we were not even preserving any possible issue for appellate review at that point, because they hadn't been asserted. She was basically making that statement in dicta because she had held that she was dismissing claims based on the fact that they were claims for benefits, not claims for breach of fiduciary duties. Does that answer your question?
Well, go ahead.
Okay. And I would point out that plaintiffs and parties may file amended pleadings as of right prior to the filing of a responsive pleading. So we did have a right to file an amended pleading in this matter and to state a claim that had not been stated before. I have cited to a case in the brief, the reply brief, that states that a responsive pleading does not include a motion to dismiss. And in this particular matter, no responsive pleading was filed in this matter until March 26, 2001, which was well after the second amended complaint was filed with the court. So I would also submit that we had a right to file an amended complaint at that point.
Ms. Ayers, what was the amount of the attorney's fees and costs that were taxed as sanctions?
Your Honor, I knew you were going to ask that question, and I was wondering that this morning. I'm not actually sure. I'm co-counsel with an attorney in Indiana, and he received and paid that amount, and I do believe it's in the record.
I'll ask your opposing counsel.
Yes, thank you.
That's Mr. James Ayers?
Yes.
Same name as yours? You have any relation?
He's my father. The second issue that the court granted sanctions on was the court stated that counsel had relied on the affidavit of an expert, Leroy Utzik, and in doing so ignored the fact that the report and affidavit were stricken from the record in this case by order of the court on October 3rd, 2001. That is incorrect because we did not ignore any court order. The court order came after we submitted the affidavit to the court, and the affidavit was submitted to defense counsel in July, and then was fully.
How was that submitted to the court? Was it a request to file in standard?
Your Honor, it was submitted along with the response to the motion for summary judgment, and we did not submit a motion to name the expert witness at that time. We were working.
Was this part of your response?
Yes, it was part of our response. It was filed with the court with a fully briefed motion. The defendant filed it on August 13th, and on that same day filed a motion to strike. And the judge ordered that the expert be struck on October 3rd, which was 2 months later. And we did not make any attempt to utilize that expert after that date. In terms of a review of the denial of benefits for Mrs. Blickenstaff, there's been some argument in the briefs regarding the standard of review. I would submit to the court that the standard of review in this case could be either de novo or arbitrary and capricious, because under either standard there was an error. In terms of an argument that the de novo standard of review would apply, the language of the plan summary description states that the claim evaluator has full discretion and authority to determine benefits payable and to construe and interpret all terms and provisions of the plan.
Well, how significant was the discrepancy between her actual capabilities and the modified description of her job with restrictions? In other words, why would it have been arbitrary and capricious for Hartford to find that she could perform the job as modified, particularly given the suggestions in the record that she might be exaggerating her limitations?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the assessment stated that she might be exaggerating her limitations and then made an assessment based upon that observation. So I think that the doctor's assessment was what she really could do, not what she was necessarily representing. It was a medical opinion.
Then my question to you would be, after the trial, Judge Barker found that Hartford relied on the job description with the restrictions, in other words, the ones that were described in this Keeling letter, rather than Mr. Snook's generic description without the restrictions. So what would be clearly erroneous about that finding?
Several things. First of all, Ms. Keeling's letter came at a later date from Mr. Snook's analysis. And Mr. Snook's analysis was utilized throughout their consideration of this claim, and they began referencing it in November after they received it. And they actually received Kim Keeling's letter, which doesn't necessarily get as specific as Mr. Snook's analysis of her ability to do her job and what the job requirements were. That was very specific. It was submitted upon observation of her after receiving a request to outline what her job duties were. The Kim Keeling letter was much less specific and just basically stated what her doctor's limitations had been on her, and stated that they had accommodated those limitations, which is not necessarily true, first of all, because Leslie Snook actually observed her in her job and watched what she was doing and submitted the job demands analysis form based upon that. But even so, even if you make an assumption that they did technically limit her to lifting of no more than 10 pounds and standing of no more than 2 hours, she was not actually able to lift up to 10 pounds regularly, and that was clear from her functional capacity evaluation. She was only able to lift up to 7 pounds constantly. And when someone's injured, a matter of pounds really does make a difference. So technically, it is still inconsistent with her functional capacity exam. However, the Kim Keeling letter was submitted on January 25th. And after that Kim Keeling letter was submitted, Jean Rudd, who made this decision, sent the letter, and whose initials are found throughout the record in terms of entries on decisions, referenced not the Kim Keeling job demands, but the Leslie Snook. And so the Kim Keeling was submitted on January 25th, but after January 25th, she referenced it on February 19th, where she said, the job requires her to sit 4 hours, stand 3 hours, walk 1 hour. She must lift 1 to 10 pounds constantly, 11 to 20 pounds frequently, and 12 to 50 pounds occasionally. Again, she referenced that on March 16th, 2 days before her letter denying coverage of benefits. She stated, and again, this is Jean Rudd, she stated that the employer has been able to accommodate and has made this accommodated job for employee permanent own occupation. Employee must sit 4 hours, stand 3 hours, walk 1 hour, lift 1 to 10 pounds constantly, 11 to 20 pounds frequently, 21 to 50 pounds occasionally. That may have been my typographical error where I said 12. Actually, that may have been hers because it looks consistent here. Okay. And then it says, and this is 2 days before she denied it, the functional capacity evaluation shows that employee is able to lift up to 20 pounds occasionally, 15 pounds frequently, 5 to 7 pounds constantly, and sit, stand, walk all frequently. And remember, this her job, she worked as a materials handler for R&R Donnelly & Sons, and this is a bookbinding and publishing plant, so this is not, you know, she's not picking up Post-its. She's picking up books and bookbinding materials, and so this is, this particular job was difficult for her, and we would submit that she was not able to perform the functions of her job, and that it was an abuse of discretion to utilize a letter submitted by Kim Keeling that was not specific about what her job demands were actually, and only submitted what the doctor's limitations were on her. So,
and you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Ayers. Ms. Murday.
May it please the Court, good morning. Donald Murday of Chittenden, Murday & Novotny on behalf of the defendant, Appley Hartford. Your Honor, coming back to your question about the award of sanctions and the amount, I am not sure of the definitive amount. I know it was far less than what we were seeking. We were seeking it on a number of various grounds. The district court judge narrowed that, found on those two instances with regard to the filing of the second amended complaint and with regard to the filing of the expert affidavit, and asked to submit an accounting. I believe, Your Honor, was somewhere in the area of between $1,500 and $2,500. It wasn't a significant fine.
Well, but there's always something significant about being sanctioned.
No question, Your Honor.
If it's a dollar. But speaking of the sanctions, both you and Ms. Ayers appear to agree that Judge Barker's sanction order was based on part on the mistaken belief that Ms. Flickenstaff had relied on the expert materials even after the judge ordered those materials stricken. So in view of that mistake, why shouldn't we remand for reconsideration?
Your Honor, the sanction award was based on two components. One, the filing of the second amended complaint and the affidavit submitted of the expert.
Right. We're talking now about the affidavit submitted by the expert.
And if I
may... I agree there was a mistake.
If I may, Your Honor, I will concede for the court that the district court judge's cite to the October 3rd order was after the disclosure of the expert report. That is correct. However, Your Honor, I would like to bring the court's attention, draw it back to, really, I think what happened in this case, what transpired in this case, was a general concern of the district court judge of the plaintiff's attorney's inattentiveness to an ERISA matter, an A1B claim, when the arbitrary and capricious standard applies and where the administrative record controls. In this instance, much argument was made, motion for summary judgment was filed, wherein we certainly make the argument that the review of the court is limited to the administrative record and nothing beyond that. And in response to that is when the plaintiff's attorney filed the affidavit of their expert, in violation of the case management order which required that expert disclosure be made.
Yes, but Mr. Murday. She did belatedly file a motion for seeking to name her expert. That would have been within the district court's discretion to have allowed the late disclosure. Why shouldn't we remand to see what the district court would have done had the district court not made this mistake?
Your Honor, I submit that there is sufficient evidence in the record for this appellate court to affirm the award of the sanction with regard to that particular aspect, given the fact that the case management order wasn't complied with. The motion for leave to file the report in Stanner was only done in response to the motion to strike that we filed, because it was filed in response to the affidavit and report of the expert.
I think this is apples and oranges, and let me try and explain why. Judge Barker thought that sanctions were warranted for reliance on the expert's materials, when in fact Ms. Ayers didn't cite to the expert materials once the district court orders them stricken.
Your Honor,
why is she being sanctioned for this?
I agree with Your Honor in the looking at the order as phrased by the district court judge. The sole reason she cited in the order would be inaccurate. I concede that fact. What I am saying to Your Honor and to the rest of the panel is that there were additional reasons given for the award of sanctions with regard to that.
By the district court?
By us in arguing
with
the district
court. By the district court? The district court gave a reason. The district court didn't say, look, all those reasons that Mr. Murday has cited is why I'm doing this. The district court said, this is why I'm doing this. She discounted your reasons, I guess, if it isn't in the order.
I don't know whether discounted, Your Honor, or she just took one of the reasons and said, this is sufficient for me.
But that wasn't a real reason. It was an error.
I agree with Your Honor that the October 3rd order postdated the disclosure of the expert report. I agree with that.
So shouldn't we remand for reconsideration?
Your Honor, as I suggested, I think there's sufficient grounds for this panel to affirm that award on other arguments that were made before her and that are of record and before this court.
Did the magistrate judge in this case inform the parties that the record would be limited to the administrative record?
Yes, Your Honor, the magistrate court did do that. The magistrate judge did do that.
Was that ever modified by the district judge?
No, that was not, Your Honor. Briefly, with regard to the filing of the second amended complaint, I think just briefly, because I do believe the most important issue is getting to the actual determination of Hartford and whether it was arbitrary and capricious. However, since it was raised, I feel duty-bound to address it briefly. The complaint was filed in state court in Indiana, removed to the federal court pursuant to ERISA, although ERISA was pled in the face of the complaint. We moved to dismiss on behalf of the parties who were not the plans. As this court well knows, the plan is the only proper party in A1B claim. In response, plaintiffs conjured up a theory of perhaps it's an A3 claim. I believe the district court handled that very properly and appropriately, saying the only claim that's here is an A1B. There is no A3 claim. She goes on to cite the law of the Seventh Circuit indicating that there is no A3 claim when all the party is seeking is a payment for benefits. And that is why she moved to, or she held, that the counts against Donnelly and Hartford were to be dismissed with prejudice. And she does explain that there is no reason to replead the breach of fiduciary counts. And that's why when they filed the motion for leave to file the second amended complaint, she granted leave and then handwrote in herself on the order given by the plaintiffs that she doesn't pass on the sufficiency of the second amended complaint. And then in response to our motion to dismiss, indeed, agrees with us and finds that those counts were dismissed with prejudice.
Is it clear from the face of Ms. Kewing's letter that the job description of Hartford was to consider was the job with restrictions rather than the unrestricted portion that was described by Ms. Snooks?
Yes, I do. And Your Honor, the fact is, if in looking at the administrative record, I think what is clear and why the district court judge found it hard to grant summary judgment in this instance was because there was a conflict in the record of job descriptions. And while I believe the court in her entry of the final judgment indicated that while she could have made those findings at the summary judgment, she didn't think it was proper at that time. She felt that she would need to have a trial on that and not do it under the summary judgment standard. But if you look at the record, in early January of 1999, there was a phone call from the employer to Hartford indicating what the restrictions were. And then Hartford called the employer back and at that time spoke with Ms. Kewing. and Ms. Keeling indicated orally what the job restrictions were and walked through the litany of events. The fact that while Ms. Blickenstaff was a material handler, she became disabled, came back in June with a modified job description, with a restricted job description, and that became permanent, and then she became disabled in October. And if you look at the record, Hartford was very concerned about that because they wanted to know if it were the same job, then they wouldn't even be on the hook for disability benefits, which is why they wanted to make sure that this was a new job description. The conversation was held with Ms. Keeling. She, in fact, confirmed that in the letter in January of 1999. I think what's also extremely important to note is not only was Hartford very concerned about the treatment that the insured was receiving in this instance, but also what kind of capabilities, what was her functionality, what could she do, what could she not do. And in this instance, there were discussions, and the record is clear, that there was some mention that the health insurer may conduct this functional capacities evaluation. There are indications from the treater that they think that the health insurer will provide that because the treaters, frankly, didn't know what was going on. They were getting different complaints of pain. I think the record is clear that they were concerned that perhaps Ms. Blickenstaff was reading up on perhaps WebMD.com or whatever it may be and coming in and giving all of the symptoms of fibromyalgia when they frankly couldn't find any objective findings for that. So they frankly were kind of throwing their hands up, and they encouraged that the functional capacity evaluation be done. When it was clear that the health insurer would not do that, Hartford went ahead and asked for it to be done. Prior to that, and I think it's important to note, I don't think it's made as clear in the record as I would like in our briefs, the fact of the matter is Dr. Williams is the treater of Mrs. Blickenstaff. In November of 1999, he was given the functional capacities evaluation or a functional demands evaluation for Ms. Blickenstaff. In that report, it was sent to him in November of 99, to which he responded in December of 99, he indicated that she could lift up to 10 pounds. He indicates that in his report, her treater. Now, there's been mention of Mr. Snook's evaluation done. I think it's, again, important to note for the record that was completed in November of 98. Ms. Blickenstaff wasn't working in November of 98. Therefore, obviously, he wasn't observing her at the time. Clearly, his observations that he made in that report were done from past recollection. And what did he do? He went and pulled the job. He knew that she was a materials handler. He went and pulled the description. And because of the confusion, that's why Hartford went back later to the employer and said, give us her job description. There is some confusion. Give it to us. And, in fact, that's what prompted Ms. Keeling's letter and the phone calls in January of 1999. Moreover, in February, before the functional capacities evaluation was performed by the independent facility, there was an APS completed by Dr. Williams where he again identified that the insured can lift up to 10 pounds. So here is her own treater indicating that she can lift up to 10 pounds. There is a modified job description indicating that she will be required to lift no more than 10 pounds. She is now sent to an independent, granted it at Hartford's expense, but an independent evaluator, and they come back saying, one, we think that this woman is malingering, so we're somewhat hard-pressed to support some of the complaints that she has given us and some of the findings, but even with that, she can do light physical work. She can lift up to 10 pounds. It is stated in the first sheet of their evaluation. That evaluation was then shared with Dr. Williams, her treater, who writes back saying, I don't disagree with this report. I agree with the findings of the report, and the report indicates she can do light duty for 8 hours a day. Light duty includes lifting up to 10 pounds. So at that point in time, Hartford says, okay, here we have an insured who perhaps is malingering. We have her treater who says she can lift up to 10 pounds. We have an independent company who says she can lift up to 10 pounds. Her limited job description, the restricted job description, says that she will only be required to lift up to 10 pounds. They certainly, at that point in time, had it was certainly reasonable at that point for them to terminate her benefits. She then appeals, and in her appeal says, I have fibromyalgia. We go back to the treater. The treater says, never diagnosed her with that. I think that's where he specifically says, I think she is coming in after doing some research on symptoms and giving me all the symptoms of it. However, I find nothing objective to support that. We again ask him if he agrees with the functional capacities evaluation that was performed. He does. We go back to her and say, your appeal is denied. She again files a second appeal. And this time she has the physician that's employed by R.R. Donnelly. And in response to the letter we receive, then we go back to that very same doctor and say, hey, here is the functional capacities evaluation that we have done. If you have any objection, if you think that this is inaccurate in any way, shape, or form, let us know. He writes back saying, I find it to be accurate. I have no objections with any of the findings found. So we go back to her and say, your second appeal is denied. And then lastly, a third appeal is denied when she has retained counsel and he submits the report of a doctor who sees her for the very first time in May of 99, some 2 months after the benefits have been terminated. And Hartford rightfully says at that point in time, sorry, this report is of your condition in the end of May or middle of May of 1999, not as of March 14th, the day the benefits were terminated. I think the record is clear, Your Honors, that this was not an unreasonable decision under the arbitrary and capricious standard of review, which is the review that this court must use. The findings made by Hartford should stand. The decision of the district court judge should stand as well, both as to the findings with regard to liability and the findings as to the Rule 11 sanctions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murday. Ms. Ayers.
Your Honors, first of all, regarding evidence at trial, you had asked defense counsel about it. Apparently, the district court judge was a little confused as to what was actually going to be occurring at trial. I was not trial counsel. However, my understanding is that very shortly before trial, she denied defendant's motion to limit the evidence to the record at trial. And then both parties made an assumption that basically the evidence would be limited to the record because of the magistrate's ruling and because of the fact that plaintiff was not allowed to submit an expert witness. They showed up, with no witnesses, and the trial judge, the district court judge at that time, was a little confused about why they weren't presenting witnesses. But then at the same time, she limited the information at trial, the testimony at trial, to the trial court record. So it was ambiguous at best.
Thank you, Ms. Ayers.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.